Welcome to Orchard Conversations, a podcast brought to you by the Orchard community.
To me, it's just part of the core of who we're wired and called to be as, you know, image bearers. You know, the God of the universe that introduced himself first as a creator, an artist, architect. You know, and the idea of literally what we're told to pray every day, every night is, you know, your will on earth as it is in heaven. And, you know, so the notion of joining God or Christ in that mission of restoring that broken cross-shaped connection, that broken shalom between the creator, creation, that vertical connection, that broken horizontal connection between, you know, me and my neighbor. You know, but that idea of the gospel being more about just the software side of relational healing, but actually that restoration of all things, you know, and joining God in that work.
Hey, what is up, friends? I'm Scott Hodge, lead pastor of the Orchard Community. And I would like to extend a very special welcome to those of you who are joining us for the first time. Well, listen, as we venture further into our series, Here to Create, we are unearthing the essence of creativity that lies within us all. And I have to tell you, today I'm thrilled to introduce to you and invite you into a conversation with my longtime friend, Mel McGowan. I'll tell you, not only is Mel a testament to chasing dreams from a young age, but he's also truly a very, I don't know any other way to say this. He's a creative powerhouse, this guy. Mel started his imaginative journey as an Imagineer with Disney, contributing to beloved spaces like California Adventure at Disney, Downtown Disney in Anaheim, and so many others. But his journey didn't stop there. He went on to co-found Storyland Studios, a design firm that's become quite an international sensation. Storyland brings to life the worlds we've all dreamt of, from Marvel to Star Wars, from the, enchanting realms of Harry Potter to the playful universes of Lego and Trilith Studios. And beyond the magical worlds of theme parks, they've woven their creative tapestry in places like Sports Illustrated Resort in Orlando and the Marvel Avenger Station in Las Vegas. And quite remarkably, they are now redefining the Nigerian film industry with the groundbreaking design of Studio City Kabulania, I hope I'm not butchering that, in Lagos, Nigeria. But Storyland Studios, friends, is not just about designing spaces, and you're about to discover this. It is about crafting stories and experiences that elevate our spirits. So, with that said, as we dive into our conversation with Mel, and of course, Benjamin Thomas will be joining me as well, I hope that it lights a spark within you, reminding each of us of the divine creativity we hold. And so, let's open our hearts, and I hope that you'll be inspired by this conversation. All right, hey, I'm here with Benjamin Thomas and my friend Mel McGowan. I mean, Benjamin's my friend too, but Mel, today you're in the hot seat, man. Hey, thank you so much for jumping on with us. I think the last time you and I saw each other was about a year ago, maybe a little over a year ago. We were at Downtown Disney at what's the place called? The Tiki Bar, the Trader Sam's. Is that it?
Yeah, Trader Sam's Enchanted Tiki Bar.
Which then took me back to the first time we met, which was probably, I'm going to guess it was like over 10 years ago, maybe 12 years ago, standing in line at a coffee truck in Austin, Texas. Do you remember that?
At a former crack motel.
Motel. Yeah, at least it was former.
Yeah, former. Motel right. Santa, now a very cool hipster.
It's a very cool hotel. I haven't been back since, but
I think we were the only two conference attendees that managed to find that particular
hotel. I think so, which was perfect.
Okay. Hotel San Jose, love it.
Yeah, shout out. That's right, man. Listen, we really appreciate you jumping on with us for a bit here, Mel. You are truly, man, I love every chance I get to hang with you is always good. And you are, I think, one of the most creative people I know, man. I'm curious, like, if you can just take us back, where did this come from? Like, tell me, where did this creativity come from? How is it, how did you discover it? Tell us a little bit about that, would you?
Oh, boy. I don't know. I usually blame my first memories of bombs going off in Vietnam as kind of a, like a, Alpha Point, but born in Saigon, earliest memory, seriously.
Wow.
You know, kind of contrasting. I remember bombs going off in Vietnam. My dad was a GI, and my mom was Vietnamese, kind of a Miss Saigon story. And then the second earliest memory is I remember visiting Southern California and Disneyland and looking down the lights of Main Street USA and seeing the kind of lights outlining the building, the pin lights, and kind of a little bit of a fusion of that world as it was versus a world that could and should be, I think kind of
interesting
bonded in my brain somehow. And wherever I grew up, mostly in Europe as a, military kid, but just always had those kind of weird memories of kind of where I was born and kind of this place that, seemed so far off and exotic. The States, / Disneyland.
I mean, I'm thinking about like a Disneyland, you're on these rides and there's like cannons going off and thing, but I'm imagining, I don't know how old you were, but going, oh my God, So, you really do remember bombs going off as a child.
Yeah, yeah. I don't recall any fake bombs causing any PTSD or anything for me.
Okay. All right.
Although, it's funny though, because my dad ended up working at Disney and he would tell me about some stories like kids trying to, sneak over the boat on parts of the Caribbean, spend the night in the, little Caribbean village. And I remember thinking, man, you shouldn't have told me that because that is an awesome idea.
Have you ever?
I haven't, but basically it kind of inspired kind of me going down this path of, it's a long story, but essentially learning the art and craft of Disney Imagineering, what we call spatial storytelling, and creating space where people can spend the night in that magic, in that dream, that immersion. And, that's been kind of a fun joyride, but I'm kind of jumping the...
Yeah, no. I want to talk about spatial storytelling. But first, I want to ask you, what do you remember? What is the first thing you ever designed that made you realize, oh man, I love this? Do you remember what that was?
Well, I go way back. I mean, my brother, who's now my business partner, he's our chief story officer. He was quite the Star Wars aficionado. We're a gentleman of a certain age where we remember when the first movie, first came out. And so there was a time we were managed to be completists, and I'm pretty confident we had every Star Wars play set, every bed sheet, every
book.
We had basically designed and turned his room into a, not just a Star Wars shrine. I would really call it our first experiential design almost.
Wow.
Where you come in, lights are down, the soundtrack is playing.
Oh, yeah.
We got all the different setups like in every corner, zoned properly. It was a pretty impressive experience. It was almost an e-ticket attraction. Definitely wowed the other neighborhood kids. But
you even had proper paths of egress and all of that.
We had a show path. We had ingress, egress. Yeah, we had all the architectural codes figured out.
ADA compliance.
And I have plenty of other friends, guys on our teams that kind of started in the route of, haunted houses and kind of
interesting
stuff. But that was an early start. And then that was early on. Cause I was sitting at my drafting table drawing theme parks and master plans for future cities at I think the ripe old age of 11 or 12.
Wow.
pretty young. So,
Did you ever imagine, cause you ended up going to work for Walt Disney Company for, was it about a decade or so?
Yeah. It the Disney decade in the '90s. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you ever imagine when you were a kid, one day, was that something you aspired to or?
Well, actually I wrote my first letter to Disney Imagineering. Back then it was called WED, Walter. It was initials of Walt's name, Walter Elias Disney Enterprise.
Oh, cool.
Wrote my first letter to him, I think when I was about 11 or 12. And I still have that.
Wow.
Do
you really?
I thought, it'd be a good idea to, that after my first trip to Disneyland, give him some free consulting, tell him all the things that they needed to fix, freebie ideas and, promptly got that cease and desist stay in school kid rejection letter. But had the sight set pretty early on, I would say.
So what was one thing you were suggesting in your letter to them? Do you remember?
Oh boy. That's right. Well, I can tell you one thing was simply just Space Mountain needed a paint job. So it was basically maintenance of my, but yeah, it was, I think, scraping a lot of the front section that was more sci-fi and kind of recommending that they push a little bit more into kind of the original roots of Disney, which was kind of a future that could and should be. And I think Epcot had just opened up. So they were, you know, they already had a great benchmark that, you know, of what, you know, like if Apple, you know, presented a pavilion, what would that look like? You know, that's
sure.
That's more exciting than a Buzz Lightyear, you know, shoot 'em up dark red or whatever. But that was kind of the general idea, I think, of, you know, kind of going back to the roots.
Well, Disney saw your skills because you ended up going to work for them for about a decade. You worked on projects. You worked on the California Adventure, right? You worked on the Grand. What was the Grand Californian?
Yeah, that was that first hotel that, you know, lets you spend the night, you know, in a national park lodge. It's actually, you know, we converted the old Disneyland parking lot, the 100-acre black asphalt parking lot, and turned that into a national park, basically. And placed a national architecture lodge in the
downtown Disney, right?
Yeah, we
had that. Just give us a snapshot. Like, you're that decade. What did you do at Disney?
I mean, in a nutshell, you know, when I started at Disney in 1990, you know, before Walt Disney died in 1966, he was really kind of bummed out at what happened in the area around Disneyland. The original Disneyland out here was only 160 acres, you know, probably about the same size as like your Six Flags up in Chicagoland area, you know, Great America. But it was surrounded by this kind of what the city had euphemistically called a commercial recreation zone. But what it really was motels that were built in the 50s, one-story motels that you could rent by the hour for hookers or by the month for families on the verge of being homeless, like a lot of the churches had for the motel kids. Yeah.
It's exactly what you think of when you think of Disneyland.
Yeah, well, it gets better. Yeah, because Walt Disney called it a third-rate Las Vegas Strip, you know, but by the time I got in there, it had gotten progressively worse, where we had stray bullets, you know, from a gang neighborhood that had cropped up around the Disneyland Hotel. We had stray bullets going right through the glass of Disneyland Hotel, barely missing guests in the head. Welcome to the happiest place on earth. And so it was, as a corporate partner, you know, it really got to the point where Disney was like, look, if we're going to continue to reinvest in this asset, you know, we really are going to need the city to step up as a partner. And we have to together figure out a strategic plan to kind of fix all that. So long story short, we just partnered with city. I was in the city manager's office, you know, every week in, week out, and ultimately crafted a plan to figure out how to get out of that hole, basically. And you know, not just focus on our property line in or on our, you know, kind of just throwing new coasters and rides in, but really how do you cast this vision? Ultimately that became a vision for a 2-square-mile, 1,100-acre Anaheim Resort Garden District, kind of spreading the magic beyond the berm, you know, and part of that idea was, hey, if you're going to attract a convention to inland Southern California, you know, you've really got to have something better to eat than Chuck E. Cheese and Pizza Hut. Mm-hmm. You know, you really need to go outside that core family tourist thing. And so the idea of Downtown Disney was almost related to the notion of competing with all these other cities that were cleaning up. I mean, if we're competing with Baltimore and Cleveland, these Rust Belt cities that have created a ballpark district and a Inner Harbor and, you know, kind of these vibrant retail, dining, entertainment hubs, we kind of felt like we had to kind of do that. And so that critical mass of retail, dining, entertainment, the hotels, including the first hotel in a park, it was all about increasing length of stay. From a business strategy point of view, that meant, you know, more bed taxes that actually fueled and funded all the cleanup of the city that had to happen. So it was a massive project, you know, miles of rebuilding of city streets and, you know, canopy trees and, you know, everything from stormwater to relocating and burying electrical lines. I mean, it was a massive urban design.
Can't imagine.
I call it design intervention project.
Seriously, man. Seriously.
But fun stuff.
Would be cool if there is like a documentary about that whole thing. That would be really cool just to see and how all that transpired over a period of however many years it took.
Well, I think the only place it's worthy of would be probably YouTube. So I'm pretty sure there's some YouTube out there that's gotten excited enough to create a documentary about it. But that's about it. No Oscars coming soon.
Mel, I'm particularly really taken by this idea of like what is or was and what could be. And you mentioned it a couple times. And maybe I'd love to hear you just talk a little bit more even about that. Like, it seems like the roots of that were in your childhood. And then you kind of got that like reaffirmed then as you stepped into the workplace. You just started imagining the limits were off of you, it seems like. It wasn't like, and the idea of even writing a letter to Disney, like who does that? Like kids can do that because they imagine what could be. And so like that seems to have been a little bit of a guiding thing through you. And then you've been able to see it, even like helping reimagine a city, all of those things. I don't know, maybe you could talk a little bit about that aspect of imagination and as a guide.
Yeah, appreciate that. Yeah, to me, it's just part of the core of who we're wired and called to be is, you know, the image bearers of, you know, the God of the universe that introduced himself first as a you know, creator, an artist, an architect, you know, and the idea of literally what we're told to pray every day, every night is, you know, your will on earth as it is in heaven. And, you know, so the notion of joining God or Christ in that mission of restoring that broken cross-shaped connection, that broken shalom between the creator, creation, that vertical connection, that broken horizontal connection between, you know, me and my neighbor who, you know, we differ about everything from our fencing material to our politics, yeah. to our, yeah, our religion, totally. Frankly, me to my teenage kids, you know, like, you know, like it just, yeah. You know, but that idea of the gospel being more about just the software side of relational healing, but actually that restoration of all things, you know, and joining God in that work wherever we can, in whatever small way we can. And, you know, it doesn't have to be at the city scale. You know, I remember specifically I was on a missions trip with Compassion. I was in Ecuador, and we were in this kind of, you know, just barrio, and this mom had crafted one of the most beautiful environments for her daughter that I've ever seen. And it was just so intentional, so colorful, so whimsical. And it was largely made of, you know, discarded, you know, materials, trash, toy, you know, whatever's fun. Wow. But there was so much love and intentionality and beauty.
Yeah.
And I mean, it brought me to tears. It was really powerful. And just, it really was an aha for me that it doesn't take necessarily big budgets or corporate backing or Saudi oil money, you know, to do something that
I mean, don't get us wrong, we'll take all that, but
we absolutely will, and we do. so yeah, that's led to us, you know, today I think we're designing about $10 billion of stuff around the world, and we're just, you know, trying to catch up with the demand of people that would answer that call to create destinations that lift the spirit and restore that vertical and horizontal shalom. So it's kind of a little bit of a calling, I guess. Wiring. I don't know why more people don't jump into the fray. It's a pretty fun sandbox to play in. So you're having a blast.
For sure. Let's talk about Storyland. Give us just a quick overview of what you guys do, what kind of work you do.
Yeah, well, I mean, the roots of it were just over 20 years ago. Again, I had done my Disney thing. I had done some large scale stuff for another company, but you know, I had two partners back then. One of a mutual friend, Mike Foster, and my brother, Peter. And you know, we each were friends since high school, and we just had some different wiring backgrounds. I mean, you know, obviously, I was pretty into this idea of spatial storytelling, and my brother Peter really was part of that whole .com boom. He was ready to retire at 30. you know, and he's just a technology story kind of maverick in terms of fusing those elements together and the power of technology that fuel storytelling. And then Mike Foster was just this kind of strategic, we call him a strategic storyteller, but just this marketing kind of genius. Yeah. And we just had this idea of what if we could fuse what we were doing together, because we kind of missed each other. We hadn't really hung out, you know, in the 10 years that we'd all been, you know, learning our craft. But we said, man, what if we did this threefold chord, you know, three-dimensional storytelling, 1 + 1 + 1, what if that could equal more than 3? And what if we could come alongside companies and causes, whether it's a, you know, a local church, whether it's a denomination, whether it's Disney or Universal, and what if we could basically do what kind of Disney does without even thinking about it? And again, leverage the power of story of integrated three-dimensional storytelling. We thought, man, there's some potential there to actually change the world. And so that's been our kind of basic ethos and quote strategy ever since. The team's grown a little bit more, you know, beyond three.
Sure.
So we're about 120 strong around the world today. But like I said, pretty fun stuff.
And you guys are this interdisciplinary company, right? I mean, you've got architects, artists, strategists, accountants. I mean, you've got the whole thing all in-house pretty much, right? I mean, that makes a huge difference.
That's the one biggest challenge we have is I've learned people mentally like to just put, you know, companies or people in boxes. And it's kind of hard for people to understand sometimes when we explain that we actually have a nationally licensed architectural practice that, you know, can stamp drawings and whatever. But then on the flip side, we've got, you know, former Pixar animators and, you know, proprietary technology that's allowing us to do real-time animation rendering. And we've got writers and creating original IP. We're working with, leading companies and causes on strategic branding and identity work. So it's a weird mix that, again, all things that Disney used to do inherently in-house, even just at Disney Imagineering, we used to say that, hey, architecture was only one of over 140 different disciplines. So for us, it's all necessary stuff to do that holistic integrated storytelling. But, a lot of times when people meet one of our team members, it's kind of like, you know, trying to describe an elephant by, you know, just touching the right. trunk. You know, they come right. in and they've just yeah. touched one aspect of the organization. But we say no to a lot, actually, if it doesn't, relate to our core mission of telling better stories and having stories that, basically change people and change the world, then we'll say no to it. But it's a nice synergy so far.
Go ahead, Ben.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
We might be asking the same question because I want to hear more about spatial storytelling because I don't know if I've heard it phrased like that before, and I love that idea. And even maybe contrasting that difference between, I don't know, how would you contrast against like linear story and spatial story or multidimensional versus singular? Like, how would you describe that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for the most part, I mean, a lot of people tend to like overly glamorize, like, for example, the discipline of architecture. And clearly, we love architecture. We have a team of architects around the world. We're working with literally the biggest architecture firms in the world. But a lot of times in today's day and age, there was this rise of this term called the Starkitect, right? Frank Lloyd Wright would be an early example of that, right? And especially in the Chicagoland, Daniel Burnham, kind of another guy. But, you know,
four houses down from here is a Frank Lloyd Wright house.
I love it. Yeah.
And so yeah. I get to see it every day. It's awesome.
Love that idea of, oh, the singular genius. Now, challenge with that, the reality is, much like the film industry, one of the things I love about spatial storytelling, much film, is that it truly is this collective art form. That there are so many diverse talents that are required to accomplish that art form. It's not ever just one genius, fast or well he can draw. A lot of times it has more to do with the personality, how much they can talk and market and PR. But the reality is that person, I don't care whether it's Frank Lloyd Wright or Steven Spielberg, you know, certifiable geniuses are still a tip of a spear with many different disciplines. Behind them. The reality is, most architects, aren't Renaissance men. That, you know, some will get more excited about certain aspects of architecture than others. But regardless, when it comes to telling stories in three-dimensional space, the number of just pure technical functional disciplines above and beyond architecture is something that most people are completely oblivious to. It's just the difference if you walk into a hospital versus walking into some of the, let's say, a place that you would actually want to stay for vacation. And again, that place might be a national park glamping situation. It might be Disney World. It might be just a Four Seasons hotel. But, you know, when you talk about a place that really kind of connect you to the land and the culture and the people, that's very different from the old architect dropping a vanilla, you know, big box. And, you know, that same Hilton could be in the Caribbean. It could be in Miami. It could be in Chicago. Whatever, that was kind of old school of everything looking kind of just like modern or like looking like America. But, you know, when it comes to the idea of really distilling that unique sense of place, that DNA of the culture, that soil specific storytelling, that's something that quite often is actually an allergic reaction from modern trained architects who have been taught that form follows fiction, that less is more, the whole minimalist, clean aesthetic. Mm-hmm. It's really kind of anti-storytelling. If there's a story there, it's like, hey, look at me. I represent the pinnacle of all human design evolution. And what that means is either my personal, you know, style, which is really a little ego, you know, maniac kind of, you know, kind of, it's just not as rich of an experience as something that really is building on the backs of thousands of generations, you know?
I feel like it's very, one word that comes to mind is incarnational, right? I mean, this idea of Christ moving into the neighborhood and coming into our space, coming into our place, right? And I mean, I'm sure, you know, when it comes to spatial storytelling, there's so many different examples of that. I mean, would you say like video games or even utilizing or theater, immersive theater, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, you're naming two of the top cross disciplines that we pull from and that we leverage. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Theater design and gaming design, you know, the some of the same skill sets that are involved with imagining kind of environment, whether you actually build them to last, you know, for 30 years or whether they're just kind of, you know, kind of being presented as part of a 3-hour, you know, spectacle or whatever.
Can you tell us about your, I forgot where you were at, but you guys did some work in somewhere in Southeast Asia, women who you guys were working with, an organization or someone who's rescuing women from the sex trade. And can you tell us that story of like what you guys went in there and did? I don't know if this was something you did under Storyland or if this was Plain Joe or just something did. Because it really turned out to be quite a interesting project that you guys did.
Yeah, it was amazing story. It's called My Refuge House. You know, it was, it's a long story, but I have a cousin that was kind of one of my best friends growing up. And actually, you know, he was an atheist for much of his life. But somehow or another, his wife had found out about this issue of, you know, trafficking and decided to get involved and actually went over with, you know, some friends from a local church plant and went over and started a shelter in Cebu, Philippines. And long story short, it led to this process of them calling International Justice Mission. The person that picked up the phone was someone that was from was an intern that was formerly with their local church plant, and they you know, partnered with IJM and ended up hiring a former local director of International Justice Mission, and really hadn't even created their 501c3 when I first heard about this. But my atheist cousin calls me and says, "Hey man, did you hear about this issue? What are we going to do about it?" You know, because just that internal whatever wiring, you know, just propped up in his heart that this is not just, this is not right. This is freaking evil. Right. Let's kick some doors down and, you know, save some girls. And so, you know, decided to join him in that effort. And we ended up, long story, being able to create this 501c3, ultimately joining the board, created, we got some volunteers again from some of the world's top design firms, to myself and kind of our core design team. And we got out there. God gave us this amazing location. You know, the director that became kind of our client, if you will, for representing, advocating for these girls. You know, I thought at first she was really one of the toughest clients we ever had. You know, she's like, look, we need 15-foot high perimeter walls, armed security gates. You know, and I'm thinking, you know, these girls need psychological and physical, you know, separation, detox from, because the pimps could break back in and, you know, kidnap them out a lot of time. And I'm like, whoa, we're not really typically hired to design prisons or juvies, you know.
That's what it sounds like.
But you know, ultimately, you know, God gave us favor. We got this 270-degree ocean view site, you know, on this bluff overlooking the ocean. And we were able to design it in a way that felt more like these open air kind of chalets, you know, kind of villas, you know, with, again, largely ocean views. They surrounded this kind of healing garden with moringa trees that they're harvesting for pharmaceuticals. We got this Ohana pavilion, open air house, kitchen. So for these girls, it was, you know, I remember specifically the program, we ended up doing 3 bunk beds and a house mom, you know, kind of room. And so it was really more family style family dining. It was really the first time that they'd been able to, you know, live. And it was very different from that institutional, functional kind of model.
Right.
Almost every U.S., you know, architecture firm that's ever done a kind of an institution would ever conceive or think of.
Yeah.
And it ends up being a place I would happily live. I'd go there on vacation. I'd live there.
Yeah.
And the stories coming out of this place make it by far my favorite project we've ever worked on. So, yeah.
Wow.
Because we really got into the local flavor and the architecture, the open air, easy breezy kind of ventilation. Yeah. It's just really wonderful.
Wow.
I love that. I think there's so much good in that because it's like I could see someone maybe looking at that and going like, oh, if they're only focused on the bottom dollar line or like, oh, well, it's, you know, why are you spending all this time and money and energy in this? But you're coming at it from this human perspective. You're bringing dignity and worth and humanity to it. And you're creating something that feels like a place you would want to be. Like there's just so much like humanity and it's like seeing the other and being able to go, well, what's the best possible scenario? And then dreaming it out loud and doing it. I think that's a really beautiful story.
Yeah. Ironically, a lot of cause oriented nonprofit design, you know, it's lumped under this, you know, in the construction design business, it's a market segment called institutional facilities. And when you think of institutions, you know, by the way, churches are included as part of that, schools are part of that. But when I think of institutions, I think a place you want to spend as little time as possible, get in, get out. So whether it's a prison, whether it's a church, hospital, insane asylum, let's group churches into that. So I think our perspective in working with causes is like, hey, how can this be, again, a destination, a lift of spirit, a destination of people would want to, you know, get on planes, trains, and automobiles to get to. And how can we give that taste of heaven on earth? And that's really kind of the simple paradigm that we come at it, you know, rather than, okay, how can we get her done for good, fast and cheap? Definitely come into play ultimately, but still
sure.
Story is that missing ingredient that, you know, really is our special sauce.
Mel, we could talk to you all day long, but here's what I want to do. I want to hit you with some rapid fires real quick. Just give me quick answers, and then I'm going to ask you one last question to sort of land the plane for us. Is that cool?
Sure. I'll try to.
All right. If you could redesign any space in the world, what would it be?
Ooh.
Don't overthink it.
Parking lot of Epcot.
Gotcha. Favorite Disney character?
Steamboat Willie.
Steamboat Willie? I don't know who that is.
That was Mickey's first role. That was Mickey Mouse.
Okay. Gotcha. What's the most unusual material you've used in a design?
License plates. Old rusted Texas license plates. We use them for shingles. We flipped them over on the backside and used to give it this roadhouse kind of theme for a church.
That's cool. One place in the world that takes your breath away every time you visit.
Honolulu, Hawaii, island of Hawaii, the Valley of Honolulu. Yeah,
that sounds perfect. Yeah. If you could have a creative brainstorm session with anyone, living or dead, who would it be?
Scott Hodge. Dude, no brainer.
I'm definitely living, man. I'm alive. Let's do it, man.
Let's do this.
Is there a design rule you love to break?
Form follows function.
I had a feeling you were going to say that. Okay, a couple more. What's a recent design trend you're excited about?
And the breaker is form follows fiction. So don't ignore it, but add to it.
Oh, that's good. What's a recent design trend you're excited about?
Ooh, trends are give me allergic reactions automatically, so I don't have
to. Okay. All right. That's not an exciting question. All right. What design or project of yours was most challenging that you ever worked on?
Ooh, I wish I could give you specifics, but it's rough clients is what makes projects challenging, not the
creative
challenge.
Is it the clients who think they are super creative and know your job better than you know it?
That's generally a killer part of the equation. Yeah. But I don't mind coming alongside and sharing the brain damage and educate. It's actually usually more when there's a unhealthy power dynamic that, kind of just know that their decisions aren't representing kind of, you know, the broad stakeholders.
Gotcha. One last one. And then we'll ask the closing question, what historical period in design do you find the most inspiring?
Ooh. You know, I love the era between basically the 30s, kind of that birth of, you know, getting out of the, not Bauhaus minimalism, but, you know, that mm-hmm. streamlined modern kind of the era, the Chrysler Building, the 1939 mm-hmm. New York World's Fair, just kind of that mix yes. of Art Deco, streamlined modern, where you still have that idea of storytelling and design, but you have the birth of roots of modernism, but not minimalism, if that makes sense. But new technology. Yeah. Possibilities. Yeah. Fun stuff.
That's great.
Optimistic stuff.
Yeah. For sure. So we're, you know, one of the ideas I think a lot of people have about creativity is because they don't consider themselves an quote unquote artist, you know, they may not see themselves as creative. But the truth is we really believe that every person has something divine in them. There's this creative, you know, this creative part of them that's there, whether you want to acknowledge it or believe it or embrace it or not. I'm curious, what advice would you give us in regards to tapping into our creative spirit, on a day-to-day basis, regardless of whatever place in life we find ourselves? What advice would you give tapping into our creative spirit on a day-to-day basis?
You know, I think, both high level and practical. High level is really, it's understanding your full identity in Christ and the personhood of Christ. Like you said, I mean, that's roots of it, recognizing, hey, you are the image bearer and you have the potential of turning the Garden of Eden and a twig or whatever rudimentary that God has put you in. You have the DNA in you to create an iPhone, to create, you know, some of the amazing media, storytelling, content, technology, whatever. It could be used for good, bad, or ugly, but, sure. but that potential is there. But I think just from a practical theological discipleship perspective, you know, love Andy Crouch's book, I think Culture Making, if I remember right. But that was a big aha for me, that idea of just not being critics of what other people are doing in terms of creating creative content or quote creating culture, but the idea that we are actually called to help do our part yes. to shape and create culture. And you can do that as a businessman, you can do that as an Instagrammer. There's just so many avenues that you can do that in non-traditionally, you know, defined creative or artistic ways. So a lot of it is that language and definition of what we call creative and artistic. And I think if we just really reshape those definitions, that really helps a lot of people kind of make it a little more attainable. So.
Wow. Agreed. And you know what, that's like such a big part of our vision as a church is, you know, not just being a church in Aurora, but how do we become a part of what makes Aurora and other places that we're beginning to doors are opening and places we're able to have influence. How do we become a part of what makes that place what it is? How do we get on the front end of contributing? Because it is easy to sit back and critique. It's easy to sit back or copy, right?
Right.
But how do we actually get on the front end and become creators? And I think the church, I think humans are at their best when they get in that place.
Absolutely. You know? Yep. And I love seeing the across the board, you know, the truth, goodness, and beauty, you know, and I get excited when I see it from people that wouldn't, you know, do it in the name of Christ, but it's just kind of that eternity, that scratching for heaven that's already wired in their heart. Yeah. It's awesome.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Mel, thanks, man. This was really great. This would be one I'm going to go back and listen to a couple times probably. So really appreciate your time. Really appreciate what you bring. You're an inspiration, and I appreciate more than anything your friendship over the years, and look forward to meeting up with you again soon.
Thanks for being a kindred spirit, Scott. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. All right.
Appreciate it.
Wow, what a riveting conversation with Mel. Gosh, I mean, his journey truly reminds us of the boundless creativity that each one of us holds. And I'll tell you, I'm sure you walked away inspired. I'm sure you walked away with a few thoughts. But as we take a moment to reflect, I'd love to leave you with a few conversation starters. So whether you're gathered at one of our table gatherings or you're even perhaps just alone right now, I would encourage you, pull out a journal, let your mind wander through these prompts right now. But there's three in particular I would love for you to jot down or take a screenshot of or capture somehow. Here's the first one. Would love for you, friends, to recollect a moment from your childhood where you felt a burst of creativity, similar to Mel's Star Wars room.
How did that shape or influence your perception of your own creative potential? Think about a moment from your childhood where you felt a burst of creativity. How did that shape or influence your perception of your own creative potential? Here's the next one. Mel's story that he shared, and I love this one about my refuge house in Southeast Asia, really highlighted the significance of empathy and creation. Can you think of a time where your creative endeavors were influenced by deep empathy or understanding? Can you think of a time when where your creative endeavors were influenced by deep empathy or understanding? And then one more, all right? Taking inspiration from the idea of being image bearers. I love that. Imago Dei, we are image bearers of the divine. Keeping that in mind, how can you tap into your inherent creative spirit in your everyday life? How can you tap into your inherent creative spirit in your everyday life? And further, what quote-unquote canvases exist around you that you have perhaps overlooked? What canvases, so to speak, exist around you that you've perhaps overlooked? I would love for you to let these questions be a guide, reminding yourself, reminding all of us that every moment holds an opportunity to create, to empathize, and to reflect God's image in everything we do. Again, thank you so much, Mel. Thank you, Benjamin. What a great conversation. I'm positive this is one of those I'm going to go back and watch or listen to again. So many beautiful insights and inspiration.
Friends, we thank you so much for being part of our gathering today. So you know this, the Orchard community is supported 100% by people like you who are giving out of the generosity of their hearts because they've been blessed by the work that we're all doing as a community. And so if that is you and you feel compelled to take part in that, take part in what's happening here, helping people become who they're created to be, and would like to see that mission move forward, we invite you to give. It's really easy. You can do it on three ways. You can mail it to the P.O. box on the screen. You can download the Orchard app by searching the Orchard Aurora on either App Store platform and sign up for recurring giving there. Or you can go to our website, theorchardcommunity.com/give. To learn more, every penny that you do give really goes directly to the work that we're doing, and we really, it really makes a difference every little bit, even if it just seems like a little bit. I want to say thank you to those of you who do give. It does mean a ton to us. I don't want to thank you here for your presence today, for being part of this conversation, this global conversation that we're having. If you'd like to learn more about other things that we're doing, go to theorchardcommunity.com. We invite you to check out our table gatherings. They're just a continued way that we're being able to network deeper in our communities, in our local communities, and do this kind of work. And if you want to learn more about that, go to theorchardcommunity.com/tables. Okay, let me send you off with these words, sparking the divine creativity, that seed within you. May we awaken to the divine creativity that dwells within us, the spark of the infinite, the wellspring of inspiration and love. May we recognize this sacred gift in ourselves and each other, a force that connects, empowers, and enriches us. May we be emboldened to create, to express, to share with hearts open wide, with minds clear and bright. May we honor the divine essence in our thoughts, words, and deeds, a reflection of beauty, goodness, and truth in all that we do. May we walk with grace, with compassion, and with joy, guided by the creative spirit that unites us all in this spirit of Christ. And with this awareness, help us find strength, help us find peace and purpose. Go forth in love, go forth with creativity, and go forth with blessing. Peace and love to you, friends. We'll see you again next week.